Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Republican operative Karl Rove got it right when he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in March 2010. If you can control redistricting, you can control Congress. At the time, Republican operatives set their sights on states where politicians are in charge of redrawing congressional district lines. 2010 was also the first year in which state races saw a flood of new dark money, thanks to Citizens United. Republicans gained nearly 700 new seats in state legislatures nationwide in 2010, setting the stage for unprecedented gerrymandering. Newly elected legislatures with Republican majorities in states like Florida, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan spent weeks behind closed doors working on new maps. Democrats did not see this coming, but they got their first taste of these new maps in 2012, which was a very big Democratic year. Barack Obama won re-election, and Democrats got 1.4 million more votes than Republicans in congressional races across the country. Again, the Democrats got 1.4 million more votes than Republicans. But because of those newly drawn congressional districts, Republicans came away with a 33-seat advantage in the House. And this allowed the Republicans to claim a mandate without a majority of the votes. This was the first time since 1972 and the second time since World War II that the party with the most votes did not win the most seats. Today's guest, David Daley, writes that this has become the strategy for governing from the minority. If you can't beat 'em, rat F 'em. David Daley's new book is called Rat F'd, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. In politics, rat effing is a dirty deed done dirt cheap. In the book, David explores court documents and high-tech statistical analysis programs, and he interviews the chief architects that transformed purple and blue states strikingly red. David Daley is the editor-in-chief of Salon, and he joins us from NPR studios in Washington. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Wow. Well, it's great to have you. I just finished your book this morning, and congratulations. I mean, you expose so much important information. So thanks for writing this. Why don't you first take us back to 2010 when we got Citizens United, and you've got so much interesting information here about how Republicans were still reeling from Barack Obama's victory. They were kind of trying to still figure out where they were going, and then they decided to set their sights on states where politicians are in charge of redrawing congressional district lines. Take us back to that time.
Absolutely. I think the key is understanding where the Republicans were at the end of 2008. Barack Obama has won the White House. This is the fourth election out of five in which Democrats have taken the popular vote. Democrats win a supermajority in the Senate. They hold on to the House. And if you are watching the election night coverage, which I went back and took a look at from that night, the smartest minds in the Republican Party are reeling. They can't figure out where all the Republicans went. They're staring down a demographic time bomb. They know that the ethnic and racial composition of the country is changing and that it does not favor them. And the smartest minds in the party don't know what to do. There is a really bright strategist named Chris Jankowski who runs something called the Republican State Leadership Committee in Washington. He works closely with Ed Gillespie, who was the former chairman of the RNC. And one day, Chris is reading a story in the New York Times, and he has this eureka moment when he realizes, off of a phrase in the Times story, that the following year is a redistricting year. He works with state legislatures. He knows all of these people. And the idea hits him, if we can run a concentrated, focused campaign based on flipping state legislative chambers from coast to coast, we can not only have a laboratory for conservative governance in all of these states, but we can take over redistricting, especially if we have a veto-proof power over it in all of these states. So they begin the process of looking at which states they can target and how to go about doing it.
Can you talk a little bit about the rules involved here? Give us sort of a redistricting 101, because this doesn't get that much attention in the media. I'm sure most of us have seen these bizarre maps that really make no sense, and we'll talk about that later. It's almost like a child putting some drawing together. You know, you've got one line to the right, one line to the left, a circle in the bottom. I mean, they make no sense. So we've seen those maps, but I would bet that most of us have no idea how this process works.
Well, the Constitution mandates that every 10 years, every legislative and congressional line in the country be redrawn after the census. So that means that an election in a zero year, 1990, 2000, 2010, means more because redistricting happens immediately after that. And every state goes about it a little bit differently. But in most states, it's a deeply political process run by politicians. And because this is a process that those politicians have a large amount of self-interest in handling and a real agenda, it is perhaps the ultimate fox in the, guarding the henhouse situation. You have, so a state like, say, North Carolina, redistricting is governed entirely by the state house and the state senate. Even the governor doesn't have a veto. And in Pennsylvania, it's the state house, the state senate, and the governor together. In Ohio, you have a committee appointed by prominent leaders in the legislature of the majority party and a handful of the elected state officials. And in all of these states, Republicans set about trying to be sure that they had the only seats at the table and then had the ability to redraw the lines without the Democrats even being in the room.
Right, because you quote Steve Israel in your book, who ran the DCCC after the 2010 Republican blowout, and he said that the Democrats completely neglected the states, the party planned for nothing, redistricting, he said, never seemed to cross the mind of the Democratic leadership or the strategists. He calls this a catastrophic strategic mistake. And you interviewed so many people who said the Democrats were just completely asleep at the wheel.
They just whistled past the graveyard. I mean, you mentioned Karl Rove's op-ed in your introduction. I mean, Karl Rove announces exactly what they're going to do in March of 2010 in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, maybe the Democrats just weren't reading the a journal that day. But it's right there in flashing neon lights. We are going to take over Congress and lock it in by running races in Round Rock, Texas, and West Lafayette, Indiana, and these are going to be the most important races this year, and we're telling you what we're doing. And the Democrats not only didn't have the vision or the imagination to come up with this plan on their own, but they couldn't even play effective defense to stop what the Republicans announce that they are going to do. Chris Jankowski tells me that in September and October he's out coordinating in Wisconsin and Michigan and talking with people on the ground, and the Democrats are nowhere to be seen.
Why is this? You also interviewed someone who said that they try to get the attention of the coastal Democrats, people like Nancy Pelosi, for example, and this person told you that they just felt ignored. Oh, yeah, we'll look at that, but they didn't take it seriously. Why? What explains that?
It's a great question. Nancy Pelosi wouldn't talk to me. But I mean, I think if you're Nancy Pelosi, you're getting reelected rather easily from a district that you don't ever have to think about these issues. I mean, I talked with Martin Frost and with John Tanner, and Tanner is a Democrat from Tennessee, and Frost is a Democrat from Texas. And if you're a Democrat from one of those states and you understand what the Republicans are doing there, you feel like you're constantly on the verge of extinction. And if you're Nancy Pelosi, you probably don't feel the urgency of it in quite the same way. I am sure that this decade in the minority might convince her otherwise and convince her of the importance of this. I also think that what we have to keep in mind is that gerrymandering goes back 220 years. You can trace it back to 1790 and the founding of the Republic. So I don't think that these Democrats expected it to be used as quite the blunt force political and partisan weapon that the Republicans had in mind and used it for in 2010 and 2011. And I don't think they anticipated the technology that made it possible to lock in these district lines and to make them just more impregnable than they ever had been in the past.
Well, and what's so interesting is that here we are in 2016, and we'll talk about this later, but gun control is practically dead. We've got all of these extreme anti-abortion laws passing at the state level, and you can completely connect this back to the gains that were made in 2010 and 2012. And yet, as you point out in your book, when you look at the first three Democratic debates, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders did not mention any of this. Gerrymandering, redistricting. I mean, it's not even really getting much attention today.
I didn't see it mentioned in any of those debates. I mean, I was after deadline on the book, you know, after three of them. You actually see Hillary Clinton continuing to talk about how she's the progressive who can get things done. She'd be staring down the same intractable, bright red obstructionist Congress as President Obama has. And I don't understand why Democrats don't believe in taking this fight to the people. I think that the people understand, voters understand, that the system is broken. People of both sides understand that our politics have gotten too extreme and too dysfunctional and that it's fundamentally not working. And I think that the reason why is the way that the lines are drawn, the way that that changes the nature of who gets elected. It takes away any incentive to talk to the other side, to try to persuade the other side, to try to work together, and you end up with no action on gun control. And worse, you end up with, in state after state, policies that the people fundamentally don't agree with because the politicians are not vulnerable at all to being voted out of office. So you end up with transgender bathroom bills in North Carolina that 60% of the people oppose. You end up with the emergency manager law in Michigan that a Republican legislature passes and the people undo at referendum, and the Michigan legislature votes back in, and then you get the kind of poisoned water that you see in Flint. Mm. So on issue after issue, the lines matter deeply, and people think that gerrymandering is just politics as usual or something you learned about in eighth grade civics class. This is democracy in crisis, and it's a real problem.
And you point out that the first Congress after the new maps will be sworn into office in January 2023.
2020. Yes, because the first elections on these maps will be run in 2012. So we have a long way to go before there is a chance for change. And if the kinds of steps that need to be taken are not taken over the next three election cycles, it will be another decade after that.
We're speaking with Salon's editor-in-chief David Daley about his new book, Rat-Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And David does an amazing job of looking at what happened in 2010 and 2012 when Democrats got 1.4 million more votes than Republicans in congressional races across the country. But because of these newly drawn districts that make no sense, I mean, if you look at the maps, they're just, it's like a two-year-old drew them, really. They're all over the place. Republicans came away with a 33-seat advantage in the House, and this allowed the Republicans to claim a mandate without a majority of the votes. And David, can you put this in context for us? Because I feel like the media tends to simplify this a lot. We hear day after day after day that Washington is broken, we can't get anything done, they're not talking to each other. And I often think, well, who's really not talking to each other and who's really putting the brakes on this legislation? Because as you point out in your book, solid majorities of Americans would like to see gun control laws. Solid majorities are pro-choice. They want Planned Parenthood to be funded. Solid majorities want a higher minimum wage. They want mandatory paid sick leave. They want politicians to take action on climate change. It goes on and on and on. But we see the exact opposite.
Well, I think that is because we have managed to elect a different kind of Republican. I mean, if you look at all of the political science studies, Congress in this decade has taken its farthest turn to the right at any point in time in our history. And these are Harvard political scientists doing, you know, serious academic work on this. And what has happened is we've created so many districts that are non-competitive, where the only election that matters is in the Republican primary. And when the primary is the only thing that matters, and when turnout is low in a primary, the only thing that matters is the most extreme and vocal and energetic part of the base. And that tends to be the farthest wing of the party. And in district after district, you see politicians who are only concerned about whether they will face a primary from the right, so they protect that flank. You especially see this after Eric Cantor loses. He was the House Majority Leader, and when the number two Republican in the House gets taken down in a primary, it makes you think, well, they could take me out as well. Mm. I talked to, you know, Steve Israel and David Price and a number of congressmen, and they say, boy, you know, I would... At their colleagues tell them, I would love to work with you on this, but if I do, I would end up with a challenger and I would lose my seat. That's the only thing that they're afraid of, is a primary challenge right now. And you have very different Republicans being elected from these districts than you had even a decade ago.
And you even spoke to a number of Republican politicians, Republicans who work at think tanks, and they even admitted that this is not fair. I mean, even Chris Jankowski, and we'll talk more about him later, you talked to him, you know, many, many times, and sort and just said, is this really fair? And it seemed like he took a while to think about it and sort of admitted that actually it's not that fair. It's legal, but it's not that fair.
Jankowski's a very thoughtful, smart guy, but he's a Republican, and his job is to put Republicans in office. They came up with a crafty strategy to make it work, and I think his point of view is the other side could have done it as well, and they didn't.
John Tanner, you brought him up earlier. He said something really interesting about how this affects voters. Tanner, again, is from Tennessee, right? He's 71 now.
Yes.
He's had a lot of experience in politics. And he's one of those guys who like to talk about working with both sides and compromising, sort of an old school politician. He said to you, democracy, the people's will, it doesn't matter. 70% of the people like Obamacare, the polls say, but it doesn't matter. We get 50 votes to repeal it, and that's redistricting. The average citizen is a pawn. Without the protection of a fairly drawn district, the citizen is a pawn of billionaires who use the map of the country as a checkerboard to play politics on.
That's exactly right. And Tanner is one of the folks who, for cycle after cycle, he brings up a nonpartisan redistricting bill when the Republicans are in charge of Congress, and he does it twice when the Democrats are in charge of Congress, and he can't even get a hearing on it. We are the only democracy in the world that allows politicians to choose their voters and draw their own lines. And these lines are the building blocks of everything. And it is extraordinarily dangerous to leave them in charge of it.
Today we're speaking with David Daley. He's editor-in-chief of Salon, and he's out with a new book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. He writes that redistricting has become the strategy for governing from the minority. If you can't beat them, rat F them. And in politics, rat F is a dirty deed done dirt cheap. And if you'd like to join us, if you have questions about gerrymandering, redistricting, how this happened, why do you think Democrats were asleep at the wheel? And in many, many ways are really still asleep at the wheel. They're not talking about these issues. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. The toll-free, you can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, and you can tweet us at yourcallradio.org. So, David, let's talk about these districts and what they look like. You've got a picture here of Maryland's district. It's District 03, and it really does look like some of these lines don't even touch. You've got Parkville, Baltimore, Olney, Annapolis, and Pikesville. First of all, talk about this district. Why do these lines look like they don't touch?
Those lines in Maryland, I believe, they are all contiguous. Sometimes it can be one lane of a highway. Oftentimes, and I believe the district you're thinking about, it also involves some water. So I believe that there could be rivers in between them. So the maps might make it look less contiguous than it is. But, I mean, Maryland is the one state that the Democrats effectively drew maps in, and they did manage to gain a seat or two in Maryland that they would not have probably had if you were to do a proper, an equitable distribution of seats based on vote count. But the amazing thing is that when you go out and drive these districts, and I did in Pennsylvania and Michigan, I went out and actually drove the borders and the boundaries of these districts, and you begin to see that as strange as they look on maps, there are reasons for each and every one of those moves. They are all done very carefully, and the goal is always how you arrange not only the votes in the district being drawn, but how that affects all the neighboring districts, because anything you can move over can apply in a neighboring district. So if you look at, say, Michigan's 14th, which involves the poorest neighborhoods of Detroit, and it sort of coils like a snake and then uses 8 Mile Road, made famous by Eminem, as kind of an axis, and then the snake's body kind of rises up and it becomes a long, thin neck reaching up to Pontiac, which is kind of the head of the snake. And the goal is to connect the black vote in Pontiac with the black vote in Detroit and to create a district that packs in as many Democratic voters as you can in order to make all of the neighboring districts effectively more Republican. So Brenda Lawrence wins that district with 78% of the vote, and Republicans claim all of the nearby surrounding districts. There's a road that kind of takes you up towards Pontiac, and you essentially have one Republican district on your right and one Republican district on your left. You could hit a golf ball over that road and cross one district and knock it into a third. And there's a little cutout, if you look at the map, down along the 8 Mile axis. There's a small cutout that looks like, say, the state of Oklahoma, like a little miniature Oklahoma. And that is the 10,200 population town of Farmington Hills. And that vote has been excluded from the 14th. It's a wealthier vote. It's whiter. It's more suburban. And those 10,200 votes are carefully extracted and moved down. But as you're driving, you know, it's essentially one street off of 8 Mile, which leads up into this little Oklahoma cutout. And if you're just driving along 8 Mile, you might not even know it's there. And it is exact and it's specific, and they know just what they're doing.
Well, and as you said, the map makers who drew these lines had a goal to link the poorest parts of Detroit with the large African-American population in Pontiac, which would pack many, many blacks and Democrats within those lines. What does this mean for these voters, just quickly before we go to break? Because you also write that, you know, West Jefferson in Michigan is desperate and desolate. There are homes overgrown by weeds higher than the homes themselves. Vacant lots filled with tires make it look like Detroit's dumping ground. A block away on South Street, a shattered white Pontiac sports car sits abandoned in the middle of the road, spun to face the wrong way, glass coating the street. I mean, these are really poor districts. And these people, even if they do vote, really don't have much power. So what does this mean for these voters who live in these districts?
These voters are essentially completely disenfranchised and cut off. The goal is to pack as many of them into one district as possible in order to minimize their impact and influence. But the way that these district lines work on these streets, they literally sometimes are the line between hope and despair. You can look on the other side of some of these districts and the property values change and the kinds of houses change and the way the schools look change. And what happens in a state like this? I mean, in Michigan, for example, in 2012, it goes for Obama again. The Democrats win the Senate seat by 20 points. But the Republicans maintain their majority in the state house and Senate with fewer votes, and in the congressional delegation, despite 240,000 more votes for Democratic candidates, the split goes 9-5 Republicans. Mm. You pack so many Democrats into these districts that they win at 70% rates. Republicans win at 57.7% on average, but take more seats with hundreds of thousands of fewer votes. Those votes don't matter.
And so then we get the water crisis in Flint, and then in Detroit, there were so many reports about kids going to school with rats and mold to the point where it was hard to even breathe in some of these schools. Do you think this also lets the Democrats off the hook, the Democratic politicians who don't have to fight for their seat? I mean, I'm even thinking of Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, absolutely.
When I vote, she's on the ballot, and sometimes I don't even know she's up for re-election because she never has to debate, never really has to talk to voters here.
We don't have to – our politicians don't have to persuade anybody anymore because in 400 of the 435 districts, they are essentially safe. And the Democrats in many of these districts are just as safe as the Republicans are. They are essentially doomed to a minority on these maps in Congress, but their seats are largely, you know, super safe. So if you're Nancy Pelosi, you certainly don't have to worry about being reelected.
David Daly is editor-in-chief of Salon and author of the new book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And we will take your calls after this.
There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation on your call, on the telephone, or by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show, lines are filled up, but if there's an available one, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in a half hour, BBC's World Have Your Say. They'll be talking about the great election going on tomorrow, whether the United Kingdom should stay or go, leaving the European Union. That'll be World Have Your Say from the BBC just a half an hour from now at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the pesticide industry and the drastic decline of our bee population. There's a new investigation out by Friends of the Earth, and it found that companies like Monsanto, Dow, and DuPont last year spent $30 million lobbying state and federal officials to slow and weaken protection laws for pollinators across the country. So we'll talk about what advocates for the bees are doing to take on this powerful industry. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Salon's editor-in-chief, David Daly, about his new book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And in his book, David takes a look at what happened in 2010 when Karl Rove came out publicly and said, if you can control redistricting, you can control Congress. And so Republicans set their sights on states where politicians were in charge of redrawing the lines. Their plan worked beautifully. They won 700 new seats in state legislatures across the country. Democrats tasted these new maps for the first time in 2012. And even though they got 1.4 million more votes than Republicans, Republicans came away with a 33-seat advantage in the House because of these newly drawn districts. If you'd like to join us, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can tweet us at yourcallradio, and a line will open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Steve calling from Californians for Electoral Reform. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My name is Steve Chesson. I'm president of Californians for Electoral Reform. And I want to make 3 points and have your guest respond to them. First is that studies by FairVote and others have shown that the gerrymandering only accounts for half of the Republicans' margin in Congress, that just plain demographics accounts for the other half, because Democrats tend to be concentrated in urban areas, so they are maybe like 60-70% of a district, whereas Republicans are more spread out, so they may only be 50-55% of a district. The second point,
Steve, because your questions have a lot of detail, why don't we take them one by one? So, David, what about that? Steve says that gerrymandering accounts for about half of these seats because so many Democrats are in urban areas.
I think the best way to think about this, and this is often called the Big Sort theory, after the book The Big Sort, the Democrats simply like to, you know, live around other Democrats, that people who like girls live in one place and people who like two broke girls live someplace else. And I think the best way to debunk that is to look at the results from Pennsylvania in 2008 and in 2012. You have very similar results in both of those years. Barack Obama wins the state, and Democrats win the aggregate vote for House of Representatives by a similar margin. In 2008, that adds up to 12 Democratic seats. In 2012, it adds up to 5. So is it possible that hundreds of thousands of Democratic voters sorted themselves? I suppose it's possible, but it just doesn't seem likely to me. I think the better answer is to the question of what changed in Pennsylvania between 2008 and 2012 is that the lines of the maps changed. We don't have to draw these maps in such a way as to pack all of the Democrats into one place. I mean, to stay in Pennsylvania for a moment, Shaka Fatah, who just got convicted yesterday, so he's in the news here, and will likely be leaving office, but he was the Democrat who had the biggest margin of victory of any Democrat, I'm sorry, of any member of Congress in the country in 2012. He won by some 300,000 votes. Those 300,000 votes could have been spread out into other districts. They weren't, because the maps were intentionally designed to keep those other districts red while packing as many votes as they could for him into that one place.
And you also quote Nicholas Godert in your book, a researcher at Washington University in St. Louis, saying that Pennsylvania is the most distorted map in the country in terms of comparing the vote share and the seats won. All right, thank you for that question, Steve. What's your second question?
Excuse me. The reason why gerrymandering is so effective is you don't need all the vote in the district to elect somebody. You only need slightly more than a half. And you don't need all the seats in the legislature to control it. You only need slightly more than half. So that puts what is called a threshold of control at slightly more than 25%. If we use proportional representation for multi-member districts, for example, three-seat districts, then the threshold of control goes up to 37%. Five-member districts, it goes up to 42%. Statewide proportional representation goes up to 50%. So basically, proportional representation in multi-member districts renders gerrymandering less effective. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires single-member districts. That's a federal law, 2 U.S.C. 2C. So I'd like to hear your guest's thoughts on, you know, and that's what our organization pushes for, is moving to a proportional representation system. I'd like to hear your guest's thoughts on that.
Well, thanks, Steve.
I love the idea of proportional representation. I think fair votes, multi-member districts make an awful lot of sense. I think you would see states where – I think you would see Northeast states, which are all blue right now, have members of both parties represented. I think it would make it possible for third, fourth, fifth parties to be represented. I think it's a sensational way to broaden the spectrum of voices that get heard and to try and defeat gerrymandering. Absolutely. I'm on board with that.
And you talk to a lot of advocates, including people at Fair Vote, about this. What would it take to get there?
Well, it would take an act of Congress. And, I mean, I think that there have been congressmen who have tried, but, you know, again, the politicians don't want to give up the ability to draw their own lines. They like being able to do that. It is a lot of power, and it keeps them safe. So in order to see any kind of radical electoral reform in this country, people are going to have to work and demand it.
Hmm. Well, we have a related question about politicians who are benefit from these policies. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. My view is the situation that occurred after 2000 census was that Democrats were going to reapportionment the congressional races particularly, and Karl Rove is supposed to have approached Nancy Pelosi and said, we're going to take this to court, and if you give us 21 safe House seats, that'll be fine with us. Just drop 21 safe House seats, and for the next 10 years after that conversation, only one Republican lost a seat. That was Mr. Pombo over in the East Bay, and all the other Republicans were safely safely protected. It's interesting to note that after the 2010 census and the voters here in the state of California put in that new system of reapportionment, when it first went into effect in 2012, 16 members of the House left office. Either they were beaten in primaries, defeated in the general election, or decided they weren't going to be reelected. So 16 members changed hands just like that after 10 years of dormancy, but only one Republican lost his seat. So I think one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi didn't pay too much close attention to this after 2010 was that she has benefited from this program throughout her career. And, of course, in the past, back in the 1980s, the Democrats were notorious for drawing up safe seats to protect certain people. So both parties have done it over the years. That Republicans now are better at it than anybody else.
Thank you, John. David, your thoughts?
You make a lot of points there, a lot of them very good. I think that the Republicans are better at this than anybody else right now. I think that in 2010 and 2011, the technology improved to such an extent that if you were in charge of this, you would be able to lock it in and drive it home. I think commissions are a terrific way of trying to get some of the politics out of this. You're absolutely right. You had something like 500 congressional elections in California between 2002 and 2010 before the commission there went into effect, and you had one incumbent defeated, and immediately in 2012 you see a change once there is a different way of drawing the maps. So it certainly can work. Commissions have worked really well in Iowa. They've worked well in California. They've worked a little less well in Arizona, I would argue, but I think that's the case. As far as Rove back in 2001 and Pelosi, I don't know that specific story, but I think we're probably conflating the California delegation with the national delegation there. It could well be that they had those conversations, and certainly redistricting benefits those who are in charge, and they like to be able to keep those lines. In 2011, Republicans controlled the drawing of 193 districts across the country, Democrats 44, and you had 88 of them in the hands of commissions. So when you only have to get to 218 for control, that gives you a pretty good head start.
What happens when the control is in the hands of commissions? Because you also quote an interesting man, Sam Wang, who's a neuroscientist at Princeton, and he's really good with technology. He's really good at calling races. And he told you that if all of the lines in the country had been drawn by nonpartisan commissions, it would have led to a swing of 23 seats toward the Democrats. So it would be 222 for the Republicans, 213 for the Dems. And then he also said that John Boehner would have had 15 fewer seats at the time.
Yeah, well, I think that when you have tighter, more honest numbers like that, what you have is a different kind of politician elected. I mean, John Boehner was the Republicans thought they were doing something very smart here. They thought they were locking in control of Congress for the next decade. What they didn't realize was that they were going to elect a new breed of Republican congressmen that the caucus was unable to control. And John Boehner ends up being undone by Mark Meadows, a congressman from North Carolina who is elected on these new maps in 2012 out of North Carolina, who is a Tea Party Republican representing a district that had been held in North Carolina by a conservative Democrat named Heath Shuler. And he files the motion that essentially leads to the ouster and resignation of the speaker. They were not able to control the new congressmen that get elected from these districts, from these completely safe, uncompetitive districts. And they energized the angriest base of the party, and they weren't able to control it in the 2016 presidential primary either. I mean, if you were an establishment Republican running there named Jeb Bush or John Kasich or Chris Christie or Scott Walker, you did not fare very well. All of this helped create the conditions under which Donald Trump could walk in and just take the party away.
David Daley is editor-in-chief of Salon and author of the new book, Rat-Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And let's go next to Marty in Berkeley. Hi, Marty. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And thank you, Dave, for your book. It's terrific. Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on
the
air.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, okay. So basically, I think, I don't know if David mentions this in his book, but I think the turnout differential between Democrats and Republicans, you know, between the presidential elections and non-presidential elections is really a significant factor. And there's a simple solution for Democrats, which is to move some of the state elections, in particular for the governor's office, from the non-presidential elections to presidential elections. And that would certainly give them a lot more power in redistricting. And I think that's possible, even though the Republicans control a lot of the state legislatures and the governor's offices, you can do it by initiative. And there was some preliminary work in Michigan that they talked about it. I don't think they went ahead with it. But if you look and just, you know, simple statistic, when a governor's election is held in a presidential year, 2-1, it goes in favor of Democrats. They elect twice as many governors. But in a non-presidential year, the Republicans do 2-1. And the disparity is so huge that, you know, of course, you could switch the elections as well or combine state legislature elections, governor elections with presidential elections. It would help with campaign spending. It would help in many ways. And I think it would be very popular, and they could probably do it in 2018 and have the new elections for governor in 2020, where they would be consolidated with the presidential election of 2020, in time, of course, for the next redistricting.
David, what do you think?
I don't think you need a statute for that. I think Democrats could just turn out and vote in non-presidential years. They don't do it, and it is a real problem. I do mention that in the book, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's one of the significant problems here is Democratic voters tend to turn out to vote for president, and then they think they're done, and Republicans understand that's not the case, and that has to change if the Democrats want to unwind this, because the only way to unwind this is to take control of state legislatures and to try to get a seat at the table when redistricting is done next time. And that's going to be a state-by-state process. It's going to be a local process. And it's going to involve winning elections and being organized in 2016 and in 2018 and in 2020. And if Democrats think that all they have to do is win the presidency and that that's enough, that's a recipe for exactly the kind of gridlock we have now.
Did you talk to these Dems and these operatives about true alternatives? Because you do have really low voter turnout, and a lot of people feel like things have moved so far to the right, and, you know, Dems are sort of, some are like moderate Republicans, for example, and people feel like they're not offering a true alternative.
No, I think you're right. I think that, but there's a really easy solution, and that's voting. You know, Democrats only come out every 4 years and vote for president. And if they want to take their party back, if they are interested in having a seat at the table in redistricting, they have to vote in local races, they have to vote in state house races, and they have to pay attention to these down ballot races that the party has ignored, but also the voters have ignored. I mean, I think all of these Bernie Sanders voters who are interested in taking over the party, who are outraged over superdelegates, who want to see a political revolution, well, channel your energy outside of the presidential race at this point and start thinking about these down ballot races. It's perhaps less sexy. It's perhaps less exciting. But that's what the Republicans did. It's the hard work of political organizing, and they pulled it off, and you see the results.
It seems like Bernie Sanders got that at the very end of his campaign. He was talking about running for office, run for the school board, run for state senate, and now there's a new group called Beyond Congress, and people are signing up to do just that.
Politicians always realize the importance of districting right at the end of their campaigns. I mean, Barack Obama mentions it in the State of the Union this year. I mean, maybe he should have recognized the importance of redistricting 8 years earlier. Ronald Reagan mentions it in one of his last interviews as president. And I mean, certainly Ronald Reagan had to deal with a gerrymandered Congress of his own under Tip O'Neill. But, you know, it's only in that one of his very last farewell interviews with David Brinkley that he actually says, well, you know, I'm going to do something really, really radical here, and I'm going to suggest that maybe we should think about how we draw the lines. So, you know, and now Sanders, you know, realizes it at the end as well. It would be terrific if we recognized now that this is not a sleepy subject. This is the essence of democracy.
Why do you think this doesn't get more attention in the media, given its importance?
You know, I think it bores people. I think people think it's not exciting, and they think that it's politics as usual, and they think both sides have always done it, and they think, oh, it's the big sort, it's not the lines. All of this has changed. I mean, it may well have been politics as usual in the past. It is now a full-scale crisis of democracy because of how new technology allows these districts to stay in place for a decade and are impenetrable and impregnable.
Just quickly, it's amazing to look at how the technology has improved over the past decade. Where do you see the technology going from here?
It's only going to get scarier. The people who are doing this now and who have been involved in redistricting in the last cycle look at the advances that are happening right now, and they think that they will be able to have these predictive algorithms in place for the 2021 redistricting that will look at, that will take all of the demographic information and all of the economic information and all the voting information you can feed into the program and tell you what the district is going to look like in 5-6 years. And so the lines can be drawn predictively based on where the computer thinks that the district will be in a few years. It's kind of the same way that Amazon can tell you what other books you might be interested in, or Netflix might tell you what you want to binge watch next. those kinds of algorithms are going to target democracy.
David, we've got a number of questions about what can be done about this. You've got some interesting examples in your book. In 2010 in Florida, the Nonpartisan Fair Districts Now Coalition sponsored two statewide amendments that demanded an impartial approach to redistricting. Florida amendments require a 60% majority, so any winning coalition must have broad appeal. And these amendments won with 62% of the vote. And this is in a year when Republicans swept into office. You show that in 2015 in Ohio, voters overwhelmingly approved 71% a ballot issue to expand the state's apportionment board from 5 members to 7 and to give the minority party a larger role in the process of drawing these districts. You look at Maine, for example, same kind of thing is happening where it's easier for third party candidates to run. Do you see this happening more across the country as these issues get more attention?
I really do. Democrats, Republicans, independents alike, we all recognize that the system is broken. But I think on top of that, we want our elections to work. We want our elections to matter. We believe in the basic ideal of democracy, and we think the side with the most votes ought to win. I think people understand the basic fairness of that. And the system breaks down when people do not think that the system is fair. Commissions have been popular in red states and blue states, Arizona, California, Ohio, Florida. They come with problems if the politicians figure out how to insinuate themselves back into the process. But every reform in our political history has to be safeguarded against that kind of incentive from the politicians. So it does work if you can force it onto the ballot and if you can get a fair vote. I do think that commissions, along with some of the other election reforms that we have talked about, represent the best opportunity to generate change here, because I don't see the Democrats doing what they need to do organizationally over the next election cycles to change this. And even if they were to do that, all it would mean is millions of dollars more going into our politics, most of it being raised from horrible places, most of it going into negative ads and poisoning, you know, our state house and Senate races the same way that our national races.
David Daley is editor-in-chief of Salon and author of the new book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. David, thank you for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Jora Call, we'll have a conversation about the pesticide industry and the drastic decline of the bee population. According to a new investigation by Friends of the Earth, last year, the industry, led by Monsanto, Dow, and DuPont, spent more than $30 million lobbying state and federal officials to slow and weaken pollinator protection laws across the country. So what are advocates for bees and other pollinators doing to take on this powerful industry? It's Jora Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.